Harvard in 2005 as a professor at Yale University. He's an author of more than 200 highly cited publications, including a famous book of on quantum phase transition that you know. According to physics author rank algorithm, he's in top 0.0038% of all the authors. Let me just mention that he's Alfred Sloan Foundation Fellow, APS Fellow, John Simon Guggenheim Fellow, and distinguished researcher, just a few. And today he'll tell us about compressible quantum liquids, field theory versus foil.
Okay, well, thank you very much. Pleasure to be here, and thank you all for coming. So the title is rather technical sounding, but just to give an introduction, there are many problems in condensed matter physics which involve understanding different types of compressible states of quantum systems. And I'll define what I mean by compressible in a minute. And some of them we understand very well, like ordinary metals have Fermi liquid states of electrons, which we understand extremely well. But there seem to be many other classes of compressible states found in many materials, which I really won't go into much today, which have been the focus of much study in condensed matter physics. And more recently, in the last 2 or 3 years, there's also been techniques drawn from string theory, which go by the name holography here, which have also been applied to these problems. And one of the major really difficulties in the field has been these two strains of thought have been rather distant from each other. And today I'm going to try to bring them a little bit closer together and see whether we can really understand what's going on by comparing these very different approaches, one coming from condensed matter physics and the other from string theory. So I'm not going to assume you know any string theory, I don't know. Please speak up because I may end up using concepts that are not familiar to some part of the audience. Okay, so I should begin by mentioning my collaborators, Lisa House, who's a postdoc at Harvard, as is Brian Swingle, and Max, a former student of mine, who's now at KITP in Santa Barbara. So let me just begin at the beginning and just define what I mean by a compressible quantum liquid. So it's really a very simple definition, but I'll present it very generally, but it's exactly what you think. So just to be specific, we take it in some infinite quantum system. It will require to be translationally invariant. It could have a lattice, but for simplicity, let's ignore that. And really the only thing I require that there'd be some global conserved charge, which I call Q. And in condensed matter application, that's usually the electron density. It could be the electron spin also. And I'm going to assume I'm dimension D greater than 1. Okay. So what's a compressible system? It's really any system in which the expectation value of Q can vary smoothly as you change a chemical potential. That's really all there is to it. So you take your Hamiltonian, go to the grand canonical ensemble in a chemical potential mu, and then demand that dq d mu be non-zero. Now, this is a very natural and simple thing normally, but when you go to zero temperature, this is a highly unusual thing. It's actually very hard for systems to do this for the simple reason that h and q commute with each other. That's what the conserved charge means. And immediately, it's in fact very easy to show that any compressible system cannot have an energy gap. So if you have an energy gap, then there's a two-line proof that dq dv must be zero, because if you have a gap between the ground state and the excited state, and then you change mu a little bit, well, the energies will move a little bit, but the eigenstates won't change at all, because the eigenstates of h and q are exactly the same. They commute with each other. So because the eigenstates won't change, the ground state wave function will remain the same, and so the expectation value of q will remain the same. So the only way you could have something be compressible is by having the ground state change continuously as a function of mu, and that can only happen if there are excitations with arbitrary low energy. Okay, so since it has to be gapless, in field theory, the most natural way to get gapless systems is to make them conformal. Some quantum critical points are relativistic field theories, and conformal field theories have been studied a lot. But these are actually also not compressible, simply because the density of states, there are low energy excitations, but there's not enough of them. Their density vanishes as E goes to zero with power D minus one. And so if you just compute the compressibility of the vanishing density of states, it's zero. So really, that's why they are so complicated and difficult, because you have to make them gapless, and you can't make them relativistic of this type. Okay. So what are the systems that we know that are compressible? Well, there's really only three systems that are well understood or thoroughly understood. There's, of course, you could break the translational symmetry. So you get a solid of the electrons, a Wigner crystal, or some stripe or something. And then here, if you add more electrons, change the chemical potential, the lattice spacing can change continuously, and that's why it's compressible. You could also break the U1 symmetry associated with the charge Q, and that will give you a superfluid. And that's also compressible because you can put more particles in the Bose condensate. So both of these examples break a symmetry. So if you don't want to break a symmetry and you want to be compressible, there's really only one way to do it. That's thoroughly understood, and that's a Fermi liquid. So one way to think about it, let's start from a relativistic field theory. So for the string theorists in the audience, this is just a CFT. For the kinetic matter people, this is a graphene. And now graphene in this sense is incompressible because, as I said, the density of state vanishes when the chemical potential is here. But if you apply a voltage, then you fill up the electrons up to some finite Fermi energy, and now you get a compressible system. And that energy can, of course, move up and down, and the charge density can vary smoothly. So now you see another reason, very important feature of a compressible system. It has a line, in this case, of zero energy excitations, and that line is called the Fermi surface. And it's because there's a line of zero energy excitations that it has enough low energy states to make it compressible. So this is for free electrons, but as we learn in many body theory, this kind of description is true for arbitrary strong interactions in principle, at least as long as it's adiabatically connected to the free Fermi state. And in the strongly interacting system, the only low energy excitations are quasi-particles along that line, which have an infinite lifetime right on the line. And another important feature of Fermi liquid theory is that the area enclosed by the circle doesn't change as you change the interactions. It's in fact determined just by one quantity, and that's the charge density Q, and that's the famous Luttinger relation. Okay. So this is a characteristic property then of a Fermi liquid. All right, so that's basically exhaust the classification of all known compressible states in solid state physics that are fully understood. But clearly, there's a lot of experimental reason for looking for others, and that's other exotic phases. And so I'm not going to discuss the experiments here. I'm just going to present a field theoretical and then a holographical approach to understanding strongly interacting or exotic compressible phases of matter. Okay. Which exclude these three. Okay. So I'm going to begin with the field theory approach. So now I'm going to use condensed matter methods to discuss more exotic compressible phases. But before I do that, let me first just quickly review the Fermi liquid. So this is the Fermi liquid, electrons which have long lifetimes right along that line. So here's a more formal way of saying it. You have some fermions which have a quadratic, which have some dispersion that goes to zero along that line, and they have some short-range interactions. If you compute the fermion Green's function, it has a pole which crosses zero when k equals kf. So kf is this line, and the pole crosses zero there, and the imaginary part of the pole goes to zero as omega squared or k minus kf squared. And that's a characteristic property of a Fermi liquid. And also the area here is equal to Q. That's the Luttinger relation, okay? So that's a lightning review of graduate quantum many body physics. And there are many textbooks on this. All right, so now we want a more exotic state. And one of the simplest places where an exotic state turns up, and this is really the extent to which I'm going to give the microscopic origin of this, are some models of spin liquid. So you have electrons whose spins are fluctuating, say, on the triangular lattice. And there's a simple model of a spin liquid in which you think of these electrons as whether the spin of the electron is free to move around, not the charge, and the spin is described by this F, the same F operator, which is now called a spin-on, the fermionic spin-on, which can have its own Fermi surface. But because the charge is localized, you have to pay the price for that strong constraint on the Hilbert space, and that appears in the form of fluctuating gauge field. So the simplest model of a non-Fermi liquid phase that has been studied extremely well, extremely thoroughly now in condensed matter physics, is this very simple Lagrangian. It just differs from this Lagrangian by just having a long-range a gauge interaction. Now you might say, well, what about ordinary electromagnetism? Doesn't that also affect behavior of the Fermi liquid? Well, it does, but because alpha squared is 1 over 137, so weakly coupled, that only happens at ridiculously small energy scales, before which other phenomena take over anyway. So it's never important. These gauge fluctuations are never important for an ordinary Fermi liquid with ordinary electromagnetism. But here in this theory, because the gauge coupling alpha is about a 1 or even larger, it's really the strongest thing around. You can't ignore the gauge fluctuation. Okay, so what do the gauge fluctuations? So this theory has been studied, especially there was a very important paper a couple of years ago by Sung-Sik Lee. And among the features are, first of all, the longitudinal part of it is not terribly important because it's screened, but the transverse gauge fluctuations are not screened, and they lead to singular long-range interactions. And the resulting theory turns out to be strongly coupled in two spatial dimensions. That is, people had thought for a while that there was some kind of controlled 1 over n expansion, but that doesn't turn out to be the case. Perhaps you've heard about some of this before, and this is the subject of an entire talk, so I won't say much more about it, but to just characterize some of the key features. So one of the most important features, because of the strong coupling to these transverse gauge modes, is that this quasi-particle at the Fermi surface doesn't survive, and it's broadened a lot. So let me just say that a little more carefully. So here, this picture, this halo, is supposed to represent a non-Fermi liquid. And the haziness is telling you that the quasi-particles are hazy. But even though the quasi-particles are hazy, the Fermi surface is well-defined. There's a very precise location of KF, and that's still given by the Luttinger relation. And so this is then a new state of matter, which is compressible and which obeys the Luttinger relation. So there's been a development of a low energy theory in terms of one and two patches, which I won't say more about. But what that theory tells you at the end is that the fermion-Green's function near the Fermi surface is characterized by certain exponents. And so I don't want to belabor these exponents very much, but the one important point will be crucial subsequently is this exponent z, which tells you how energy depends on wave vector. So if I move away orthogonal to the Fermi surface with wave vector q, the energy will go as q to the z. In a Fermi liquid, z would be 1 by this definition. And the net result of this rather complicated theory from the field theoretic approach is that it seems that z is exactly 3/2, although it's not proven that this is the value to all orders. The possibly larger correction is in the two-patch theory. But just that's a number that is going to be important for my subsequent discussion. And this is really what the Green's function looks like. Again, it has a 0 when both q and omega are 0. That's what determines the location of the Fermi surface. And then it has a branch cut in frequency space, and this 2/3 exponents is, of course, the inverse of that 3/2. Okay, so it's a mess, but in the end, it's a new type of compressible state with a sharp Fermi surface, but not well-defined quasi-particles, and this scaling of energy with exponent 3/2, okay, which seems to be really quite robust. No one's ever found any corrections to this, although no one's proven this is exact either. Okay, so there's one very important property of this, I should have emphasized already, of this Fermi surface. The fermions that are these low-energy quasi-particles carry gauge charges. They're gauge charged. So in fact, this Green's function is not even gauge invariant. It's not something you can measure. So that's really one of the hard problems about this. So you've talked about this compressible phase. And the way you've done the theory is by fixing the gauge. And then in that gauge, there's a Fermi surface. And you find that obeys Luttinger relation and everything and so on. But if you want to actually do an experiment to measure this Fermi surface, it's not so easy. Unlike in a Fermi liquid, you do a photo emission and you can see the Fermi surface. Here, it's not so easy at all. You're going to have to measure some complicated gauge invariant correlation function. And the claim is that this hidden, so this kind of gauge-dependent Fermi surface is what I call a hidden Fermi surface. The hidden Fermi surface will have some signatures, but a rather complicated set of signatures in the observable. There is no direct measurement, or it seems, which can just immediately tell you where it is. And this turns out to be really crucial when we go to the second part of the talk and talk about holography, because in holography, you only have access to gauge-invariant observables. You don't even have access to this G, which you do in the field theory approach. And that's sort of set up one of the key mysteries in this whole field, which I'll try to address. OK, so that's really the key question. How do we detect the hidden Fermi surfaces in the non-Fermi liquid phases? So there have been proposals, you know, look for Friedel, the analog of Friedel oscillations. And perhaps those will eventually be used. But it turns out they're not so, at least at the leading order, they're not so strong in the holographic methods. And so far, that's not been successful. So we're looking really for a gauge-invariant observable, which will really tell you there's a Fermi surface in a very convenient way. Okay. And the answer, which was proposed recently by these three people, Ogawa, Takenagi, and Ogajin, is the entanglement entropy. So this turns out as a new quantity that's suddenly playing a role in many aspects of condensed matter physics. And this turns out to be one of the most efficient, in fact, so far the only way that works in holography. And it's really very beautiful how well it works. So that's the answer, compute entanglement entropy. And there are then very precise signatures of the not only the presence of a Fermi surface, but also of its shape. And so on. So, and I'll discuss exactly what we know about it.
So yeah. Just to make sure. So these fermions are charged fermions. They're not spinons.
These are spinons. So these are spinons.
Okay, sorry.
These are spinons. So that's why they're not detectable.
Okay. So it's not compressible in exactly the same sense.
Yeah, that's a good point. It's the spin susceptibility is finite, so it's compressible in the spin sector.
Okay. Right. It's more insulated.
Yeah, so there's a detail. If you look at my lecture notes, that's all spelled out carefully, but yeah, good point. That's a detail I don't want to go into. But yeah. And there are other generalizations where it's compressible, even the charge sector, but that's a little more complicated. This is the simplest. Any other questions? OK, so what is this entanglement entropy, for those of you who haven't heard already? So it's the following quantity. You take any infinite quantum system here and divide into two parts, A and B. And then at zero temperature, I'm going to restrict myself to zero temperature in this talk, you trace over the degrees of freedom in region B. And that gives you a density matrix for region A. And then you compute the von Neumann entropy on the usual trace rho log rho of region A. And that gives you the entanglement entropy. So there's one very important feature of this entanglement entropy, which is obeyed in almost all phases, and that almost will be important, which is that as this region becomes larger and larger, this entanglement entropy scales with the surface area, and that's called the area law. So in this picture, would be the perimeter of region A. So there's a leading term in the entanglement entropy, which is just the perimeter in two dimensions. And that's what we're going to pay some attention to. Now, it turns out there's one very important case of that's violated, but there's two cases. One case is conformal field theories or quantum critical points in one dimension, where the entanglement entropy goes as the log of the system size. So it's larger than expectation from this law. And that's been known for a long time. I think it goes back to Holsey and Wilczek. But the other important case, which is somewhat related, is the case of a Fermi liquid. So if we take a Fermi liquid and compute the entanglement entropy, then it. So in this case, I'm just focusing on two dimensions. So normally you would say the entanglement entropy should be proportional to the perimeter, which I call P. But it doesn't go as P, it goes as P log P. So it's in fact larger. There's a larger entanglement. And furthermore, the coefficient here is basically universal. It doesn't depend on anything, any of the interactions. It only depends upon the Fermi wave vector. And this 1/12 is basically the C equals 1/2 value of a 1D system. So the reason, one way you can understand this, you can think of a Fermi liquid as a set of one-dimensional systems, each dispersing transports to different points in the Fermi surface. So here's my, this is real space. This is momentum space here, kx, ky. And this particular result here is for a circular Fermi surface. So I have a circular Fermi surface, but the shape of region A can be anything you want. It's still proportional to the perimeter. And so you can think of every point in the Fermi surface here as a 1D fermion with C equals 1/2. It's a chiral fermion, and that's what gives you the 1/12 log P, and then when you sum over the whole thing, you get the additional factor of P in front. And that's one simple way to think about this. Okay, so that's what a Fermi liquid does. It has this log violation of entanglement entropy. And by looking at the KF dependence here and the shape dependence and the fact that it doesn't depend on the shape except through the perimeter, you can actually essentially conclude that this is due to a Fermi liquid. And the 1/12 fixes it. Now, what is it for a non-Fermi liquid of the type I just described? Well, we don't really know. There's, in fact, just one paper on it so far by Tarun Grover and Ashwin Vishwanath and Jang. I don't know Jang. And what they found from the numerical study anyway is that you get the same behavior, except this 1/12 is probably different. But you get essentially the same dependence, P log P. So that it would certainly be interesting to have further studies of this kind of thing to see if this works. But I'm going to assume that this is correct in the remainder of my talk. Okay, so that's then my summary of my discussion of the field theory of exotic compressible phases. They have these sharp Fermi surfaces that obey Luttinger's theorem. And then they have this log violation of entanglement entropy. There are also phases that others call Bose metals, which are spin systems which end up being described as a compressible phase of bosons. But even those phases ultimately have hiding inside them, hidden Fermi surfaces. And you think of the bosons, they're having split apart into two fermions or an even number of fermions. And all those studies, as far as I can tell, again, the Luttinger theorem also works. Yeah.
So the long-range gauge field does not affect anything, really?
Well, it changes this 1/12.
But besides that,
it doesn't seem to, at least in the entanglement entropy. This is just a conjecture. I don't think there's any strong proof of this anyway, so far.
How do they argue this?
This is a numerical study. Yeah.
So this is on the two special dimensions?
There is an analog in any dimensions. Now, as the kind of strongly coupled Fermi liquid I talked about, non-Fermi liquid, is only known to exist in two dimensions, at least from the field theory side. In 3D, going back to the work of Sohn for the quark-gluon plasma pairing in the quark-gluon plasma, there the effect of gauge fluctuation is much weaker, at least in the perturbative analysis. As you'll see later, our results suggest there may well be a strong coupling phase even in three dimensions, but no one knows what it is. It is, yes. That's been, I don't know if it's proven, but there's some very strong arguments for it. It's for the same reason in 1D, the entanglement entropy is C over 6 log L, and the C over 6 is just robust. It only depends on C. Yeah. So C is 1/2 here. Other questions? All right, so that's the end of first part of my talk. So I guess I'm doing all right, about half the time. yeah, exactly half the time. Okay, so then let's go to holography. So we're going to take a very different approach now and try to talk about compressible phases. Now, there's been a huge amount of work even in the last 3 years, but I'm going to give you probably a different perspective on it and take a more, as you'll see, much of the results actually don't require you to know very much. It just follows from waving your hands a lot. So that's what I'm going to do. So here's a one picture summary of what is holography. Why is this thing inverted? No, I guess it's okay. So this is what holography is. So here's your, it's really RG in disguise. So here's your quantum system sitting on a lattice. And if you were doing RG in real space, the way you do it is you integrate out every second site, and you get a new lattice with a larger lattice spacing and with a new set of couplings. And then you keep repeating that until you reach to some fixed point or you flow off to infinity, and that tells you something about your original system. So in the RG, in the condensed matter language, you're used to just thinking about this one scale at a time. You scale up to some, you do your RG, scale up to some scale, and then figure out the physics. And holography is simply takes a different philosophy, where you really consider the whole picture. You don't consider physics at one scale. You consider the whole picture with R. So it's sort of a redundant description, if you wish, because really all the couplings here are sufficient to figure out what's happening down there in principle. But here you keep everything. And you think of the theory as living on this one higher dimension. So you're going to start with a theory which was in D dimensions, and you end up with a theory in D plus one dimensions. And the dependence on this D plus first direction, this emergent direction R, is some reflection of the RG flow. So that's the one slide summary of what holography is about. And really, we're not going to need much more than this for at least much of my argument. Okay, so continuing with this cartoon pictures, how do you then get anti-de Sitter space or something like that? Well, so let's focus on a special field theory here where you happen to be at a critical point. So this can also be applied to classical phase transition. So let's imagine this is the 2D Ising model or the 3D Ising model, which we know has a critical temperature. So let's sit at the critical temperature and do the scaling. So what we know from work in StatMech is that 3D Ising model is described by relativistic conformal field theory at long scales. And it's a fixed point of this RG. So basically things should look scale invariant as you go along this direction. So if now take this point of view that there's a higher dimensional space in which things should be scale invariant, so what you do is you take a higher dimensional space with directions x, this is a spatial direction, this is time, and ds is the proper distance in this higher dimensional space, and you demand that the proper distance be invariant, that's the requirement of scale invariance, and that things should remain invariant under rescaling space and time. And since it's relativistic, you rescale it by the same factor. So now you look for a metric in this XTR space, which has this property, and also is Lorentz invariant under X and T transformations. And it's essentially a unique metric, and it's this metric. So this part is the Lorentz invariant part minus dt squared over dx squared. Now this holographic direction R, I can reparameterize that any way I want. It's just some direction, and I can measure length along the direction any way I want. So I choose to measure length so that the coefficient of dx squared is R squared. Once you fix that, then everything else is fixed by this simple requirement. This has to appear in front of all the other factors in exactly this way, and R has to go as theta R. So now you can easily check that these three requirements uniquely fix this metric and this transformation. Okay, so then if there's a holographic theory with one higher dimensions, it should be on a space which has this metric, and this is anti-de Sitter space. That's really all there is to it. So it's a negatively curved space and has this one emergent direction, and it has all the symmetries then, all the scale invariant and Lorentz and conformal symmetries that we know are the properties of, say, something like the 3D Ising model critical point. All right? Okay, so that's the basic essence of what holography is about.
Sorry.
Yeah.
So you're saying 1 over R squared is not, by itself, is not essential.
Well, I could always redefine a new coordinate. Let me call it W. And W is R to the power 5. And then I can rewrite it in terms of W. It just looked much more messy. So I can always rescale, redefine my length so that the coefficient of dx squared is r squared. That's just reparameterization in there. Huh?
This is somehow the most.
This is the most convenient, right? Yes. You know, this is simply related to the fact that, you know, it's a way how you set up the RG. You can also, when you're doing the cutoff in the RG, there's different ways of choosing the cutoffs. You can choose them uniformly or with some power, like Wilson did for the Kondo problem. It's related to that. Okay, so let's continue with this pedestrian reasoning and now try to look at a more broader class of systems, gapless systems, that we hope eventually will be compressible. So we certainly want to lose relativistic invariance because near a Fermi surface is no relativistic invariance, but we want to keep some features of a Fermi liquid. So here is what I'm going to choose to write the more general metric in this way. So by the same reasoning, I'm going to make the coefficient of dx squared equals 1 over r squared. Then I can take any power of r here, and I can take any power of r there. Okay, so I have two free parameters, two free exponents, one here and one there. And I just chose, for mysterious reasons, to parameterize them in terms of two numbers, which I call z and theta. Okay, that's all I'm doing here. Why I chose this particular combination will become clear in a minute. I haven't really made any assumptions yet. Other than that, there are two free exponents. Okay. So what are the properties of this thing? So again, you have to see under what are the transformation under which this metric does some simple things. And now you can see that this actually is unique. This is a unique metric which has the following property, that x goes to zeta x, just as before, but now time goes as zeta to the power z. So that's something we definitely want, because near of non-Fermi liquid Fermi surface, we found omega going as q to the 3/2. And so we want some z here. We don't know what z is in yet. So that's one exponent z. But then the proper distance, I'm going to say it goes as zeta to the theta. And in the usual CFT, theta was 0. Okay. So here I'm going to allow theta. And why am I calling it theta over d? That's because this will end up being the natural way to correspond to something else in condensed matter physics that I'll come to in a minute. Okay. So these are my new exponents. And z is obviously the dynamic critical exponent. But what is theta? Okay, theta is normally 0 for relativistic CFTs and something like the 3D Ising model. Okay, so what's happened? The key difference here is the proper distance itself is changing. It's not invariant. And there's some technical word for this in gravity that I don't know. But anyway, so it's covariant, I think, but that's not the right word. It's transforming, and that's a more general. So what does proper distance correspond to in holography? So here's something else this is the one point I will have to use some insights from string theory and, in fact, pre-string theory, which is that proper distances in holography correspond to entropies, going back to the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy of a black hole, where the area of the horizon is a measure of the entropy of a black hole. So there's something very similar to that that happens also in holography, and we know this now from many solutions, and going back to work of Maldacena, Witten, and others, so that if I take the same picture here that I drew earlier of real space RG, that was at zero temperature for a quantum system, then if I go to finite temperature, then raising this boundaries, this theory over here to finite temperature corresponds to having a more formally what's called a black brain. It's not a black hole, but it's an infinite horizon here. And the entropy, the Hawking entropy of the horizon, is precisely the entropy of your quantum system. So that's been one of the, you know, key insights coming from string theory. So here I'm just going to assume that. That's really all I need. So let's imagine that. And now let me take my system and turn it to finite temperature. And there should be then some black brain. And let's say it's at position r sub h. That's the location of the horizon. And then the Bekenstein-Hawking law immediately tells me that the entropy density goes as rh to the minus d because of the fact that there is 1 over r squared here. So each power of dx gives me a power of 1 over r. So when I compute the area of the horizon, the area of this horizon is the area over here divided by 1 over rh. And the 1 over rh has all the interesting dependence on temperature. So the entropy density, entropy per unit area or unit volume of the boundary system is just RH to the minus D. Okay, well, that's, I'm almost done now, because all I need to know is how does R transform under this. So if you take this and this and you fix it, completely fixes not the transformation of R. And that turns out to be R goes to this power. So this is how I chose things. And then now we know that temperature is just an inverse time. So now everything is done. You know, you do your transformations. And that's, if all of this is, if R goes as RH to the minus D and temperature is inverse time, and then you want to compare then how time scales with R and so on and so forth. If you do all of that, the usual kind of scaling arguments, you get this key result. Entropy goes as T to the D minus theta over Z. So this is what tells us what theta is. Theta is what's called in condensed matter physics violation of hyperscaling. So what is hyperscaling? Well, hyperscaling is a statement that the partition function of the free energy, the partition function is basically invariant under RG. And one consequence of that for the free energy density is that the free energy density basically scales as length to the power minus d, where d is a dimension of space. So if you apply that argument to quantum critical points, this hyperscaling relation, you would say that entropy goes as t to the d over z. And that's another way to think about it, is the measure of the number of degrees of freedom at low energy have an effective dimension d. And the z is just simply because space and time don't scale the same way. So what this is telling you is really that the effective dimension of the system is not d, but d minus theta, as far as counting the low energy degrees of freedom is concerned. So this is an old thing in condensed matter physics. It appeared in many other places. Hyperscaling is simply so all the examples in ADS CFT have theta equals 0, and in fact also z equals 1. So in all of those systems, T just goes as temperature to the power d. So T going as temperature to the power d is the Stefan-Boltzmann law for photons. The entropy of a black body goes as T cubed, and so on. And this is just a generalization of that to other more complicated gapless systems. And so this is telling you that the Stefan-Boltzmann law is not in dimension d, but d minus theta. Okay. All right. So that's what theta is.
So, what would be the simplest examples?
Of what?
Where violation of hyperspace.
The simplest examples would be, say, the Ising model above its upper critical dimension, where what happens is that the energy goes as 1 over u, and the fixed point value of u is 0. So you get these corrections from powers of u. So those are not terribly interesting because it's essentially a free field theory in the end. The more non-trivial ones are things like random field Ising problems. But generally, what happens, what you need is some strong couple fixed, at least in condensed matter, you need a strong coupling fixed point. But you need some other coupling to flow to zero and have the free energy to depend in a singular manner on the thing that's flowing to zero. You need a dangerously irrelevant variable, basically. It's a natural consequence of dangerous irrelevancy. Yeah?
So in the scaling law that you have written on the previous slide, did you scale R in that? You didn't scale R.
Well, no, I did, and I didn't write it down there. Right here.
So you rescale R.
I need to rescale R, otherwise it's not invariant.
Yeah, okay, so the metric is not invariant?
I have two exponents here, and I fix them by this requirement, and then you'll find that the only way this will be fixed if R also scales. I mean, R definitely has to scale. If you keep R scale invariant, this won't work. You don't have enough degrees of freedom to make it work.
Okay, so it becomes an isometry if I include the R rescale.
Yes, it's not quite an isometry because of this factor of theta. It's some, I forget what the technical term, huh?
That was actually the question.
What?
Is it really an isometry?
It's only an isometry for theta equals zero.
Right.
But it's not for theta not equal. It's something more general. But it does appear from lots of gravity theories, this kind of behavior. I won't unfortunately discuss them, but if you take a theory of a dilaton in the presence of a gauge field, you very naturally get solutions that obey this. There's many, many papers on this going back to, I don't know, who was Kiritsis especially has written a lot of papers, and Kakru and Trivedi and others. This is definitely an allowed possibility. And you definitely need it, I'm going to claim, to get a proper description of a compressible phase. Any other questions? All right, so what is theta? So there's many ways of fixing it, but here's the simplest way. So if I want a compressible phase, so now here I'm using my condensed matter bias, which many string theorists don't buy into, but I'm going to, okay. String theorists are not bothered by absence of Fermi surfaces in their compressible phases. String theorists have got thousands of compressible phases which have no signs of any Fermi surfaces. And I'm bothered by it. I say most of those are probably not right. Some of them may be right, but if they're right, I have to detect these hidden Fermi surfaces. They have to be there, otherwise I don't see how you're going to get a compressible phase that makes any sense from the quantum, from the condensed matter perspective. So we want our compressible phase to at least make me happy. And to make me happy, it has to have a Fermi surface, even though it's hidden. So if it's got a Fermi surface that's hidden, then, you know, as I said, this particular argument that this is effectively a one-dimensional system is true even for the non-Fermi liquid states I discussed. So if I want to get the low-temperature specific heat, it should be the specific heat of a 1D system, effectively. It could have a different Z and so get different power. It doesn't have to be linear in T, but it should behave like the number of degrees of freedom should be like a 1D system. And that means that the effective D minus theta should be 1, or theta should be D minus 1. Okay, so that's the first claim, that any compressible phase that's going to make me happy, at least for now, must have theta equals D minus 1. Okay. All right. More generally, that comes from just the thermal entropy. Okay, so now you could go back to this metric here and compute the entanglement entropy. So this involves some calculation, but it's not that complicated. And we're going to use a very important, really, it's a postulate, but it has a lot of support of Ryu and Takanagi, who said the following. So if I want to compute the entanglement entropy in holography, what you've got to do is, here's the boundary theory, and this is R. Then I divide the boundary into region A and region B, and I have some complicated metric over here. So what I need to do is to make a surface that comes out in the x-ray dimension and make sure that the area of the surface is as small as possible. And then the area of the surface gives you the entanglement entropy. Actually, I had a nice picture of this since I have a few minutes. So let me just show you from a previous. I removed the picture this morning, but I think I'd realize I should really put it back, given the number of. I'm going to have to pull up another talk where this picture is. Okay, let me just quickly show this. Yeah? What, sorry?
That result there, that you minimize the
area. Yeah, that's the Ryu Takanagi result. Okay. Ryu, okay, sorry. Shinsei Ryu and Takanagi. A couple of years ago.
Thank you.
Okay. So here's one way to understand it, due to Brian Swingle. So many people here know these tensor networks. Which is just some way of representing entanglement of these spin degrees of freedom. So there's some microscopic quantum system here, and these are being entangled, and you represent the entanglement in some hierarchical way by just entangling them into composite objects and then going on. So a lot of people have been working on this type of thing. And this direction then is some measure of depth of entanglement. So I want to make an analogy between this picture and this picture of deep brains in string theory, where you have some particles moving on this deep brain, which are connected by strings, which reconnect it in some complicated way. And what the strings are representing then is some degree of entanglement here. And so by this in this picture, this direction is not a level of entanglement. It's the emergent holographic direction. And these are basically the same pictures. Brian has some very pretty arguments arguing this. So now in this picture, if I take this picture, what is the entanglement entropy? Well, the entanglement entropy is you take your region A, and you want to now draw a line that cuts these bonds, and you want to cut the smallest number of bonds. And now you can see if I draw a line right here, I'll cut eight bonds right there. But if I go a little bit further down, you know, I only have six to cut, but I've made another cut because I went down. You go all the way down here, only cut two, but then you pick up more. So there's an optimal surface, and that gives you the entanglement entropy. And so the remarkable thing is that both of these simple pictures and the Ryu Takenaga give you exactly the same answer, which is this area. Okay. So now let me go back to my talk. So for this, now all I have to do is take this metric and compute the entanglement entropy. And now I've given, you know, I fixed theta by this argument for the thermal density. Theta has to be d minus 1. I have no free parameters left except z. And we'll see what z does. Anyway, let's just do it then for general theta and z to begin with. So one of the first things you find is that if you take this metric and compute the entanglement entropy, the area law, which is, you know, as far as we believe an absolute requirement, modulo log corrections, is only obeyed when theta is smaller than d minus 1. Okay. So again, any holographic dual of a reasonable quantum field theory in the boundary must have theta smaller than d minus 1. And precisely for theta equals d minus 1, you do quite remarkably get a log violation. You get, so this was pointed out in this paper, and we worked out a little more carefully all the other features of this result, which also come out, you know, very satisfactorily. So what are some of these features here? So first of all, this number eta is independent of Q, and also doesn't depend on the shape of the entanglement region, It's just some number, the analog of the 1/12th that you found for Fermi liquid. In this case, it will depend upon some features of your holographic theory, but which are universal features. Okay, so that's one important fact. Then the only dependence on the entanglement region is through this number sigma, and sigma is precisely the perimeter. So you can change the shape as you want. The entanglement entropy won't change. And this is only true for theta equals d minus 1. If you take any other value of theta, it depends on the entire shape. So that's the only value for which this works, that is shape independent and depends only on the perimeter.
For smooth,
yes, absolutely. We haven't analyzed what happened at singularities. That's a little more common. Yeah. For smooth surface.
Okay.
Yes.
Does this metric solve any Einstein equation in some
mode? Yes. So I guess I got too fast. I don't have slides of that. In fact, that's just the next slide. I need to introduce that point. But yes, it does, of course. Yeah. But these conclusions so far, I'm coming to Q. And that's the next slide. So these conclusions so far don't depend on anything except this metric. I gave you this metric. You can ask this. Well, this is depends. You could sort of see this, and you can definitely see this. Okay, so now what's Q? You're asking exactly the right question. What is Q, and how did I get Q? So Q is the charge density, of course, is that I introduced. But to see that Q is a charge density, I have to actually obtain this metric in the solution of a certain model. So the simplest model that gives this is basically Einstein-Maxwell theory with a dilaton. So what you do is you take the following theory. So now this is living in d plus, you know, d dx and dr and dt. We get the Einstein theory, r, and there's a square root of g. Then you have a field f mu nu squared. And then you have another, all the signs are off here, grad phi, scalar field, grad phi squared with some potential v of phi, and a z of phi here. So this kind of Einstein-Maxwell dilaton theories has been studied a lot. They have a wide class of solutions. but there's a subset. Well, in fact, and you will make some reasonable assumption for the large R behavior, large phi behavior of Z of phi and V of phi, and for that, the solution is always of this form. So you certainly get this, you get a white class of solution that look like this. This has been known for a while. And theta equals d minus 1 is a subset. You have to tune a certain parameter to get theta equals d minus 1, and I claim that eventually we'd like some string theoretic or other method to understand how that constraint appears here, but we just impose it by hand. So there's some constraint on the couplings so that you get theta equals d minus 1. But I claim that's absolutely needed to get the log violation of entanglement entropy or to get the specific heat, either of them, correctly. Okay, so what, and the more important thing is, what is this gauge field? So the gauge field is, in a sense, dual to this chemical potential. So here's our boundary theory in which you're putting this, which has some charge Q not equal to zero. And that sources an electric field. So just like Gauss's law, you have some charge Q, surface charge, which sources an electric field. And this electric field is basically telling you that there's a charge density. So by solving Gauss's law for the electric field, you can figure out the charge density. All right. So the remarkable thing that comes out of this is that Gauss's law is the holographic analog of the Luttinger theorem. that's how Gauss's law, Luttinger theorem is obeyed. And now, so by knowing this electric field, you can figure out how things depend on Q in a very wide class of models. And for all of those models that we have been able to solve, the Q dependence is shown right here. That is the total conserved charge. And the amazing thing is that you can put all kinds of couplings here and vary them and also vary the UV boundary conditions as you wish. But the coefficient of the entanglement entropy will not change and will always be just this. So there's some kind of attractor mechanism for the string theorist, which is the analog, which we were looking for. I don't have a general proof of it, but we have lots of evidence from specific models that this is what happens, that the coefficient here is exactly what you expect, because the charge Q by Luttinger relation goes as Kf to the d minus 1. You put it in here, you get Kf. This should be Kf to the d, I'm sorry. The charge is Kf to the d, and so that'll be Kf to the d minus 1. And so that's exactly what you expect from the earlier result I reviewed for a Fermi surface. So this entanglement, and then we've also looked at things like what happens you look at the mutual information, what happens you look at finite temperature. Really everything works. All of the characteristics that we'll be able to compute of this entanglement entropy agree with what you expect for a Fermi surface. So it's as if somehow this holographic theory knows about this Fermi surface as far as the entanglement entropy is concerned.
Does this scaling symmetry act somewhat nicely on this Lagrangian that you've written down?
Only in the IR, not on the UV.
Okay.
So on the UV, you have ADS.
Okay, so you actually
have a crossover from ADS to at least some. You could have other more exotic things in the UV too.
Okay.
And our claim is that independent of what happens in the UV, many things in the IR will be different, except that this coefficient here will only depend on Q. It won't depend on anything else about the UV. That's sort of the analog of Luttinger. In Luttinger's theorem, we said it doesn't matter what kind of short-range interactions you put on the fermions, you're not going to change the area of the Fermi surface, and therefore you're not going to change the entanglement entropy coefficient. Here, something very similar seems to happen. And we don't have a general understanding of it. We just have circumstantial evidence, we have explicit evidence for class of models that we can solve. It would be nice to show this Q dependence very generally. And to have a proof, that would be also great. But we don't have one. No, we haven't studied those. That would also be great to study, to put higher order, to go beyond Einstein gravity. We certainly haven't done it. That would be another nice thing to study. Yeah. Aninda and Rob are experts at that. Sorry about that. This is the Kf to the d. I can't believe I got Luttinger's theorem wrong. That's just the volume of the Fermi surface, right? Kf to the d, not the surface area. Okay. There's so many volumes and surface areas and perimeters, it gets a bit confusing. Okay, so finally, we're doing in time. Yeah, okay. There's a set of inequalities that appear, one of which I already mentioned. This just follows from the fact, just take the general metric. So this actually doesn't require not more than 3 or 4 lines of work. So I gave you this very general metric from this very simple scaling argument. You just take this metric and compute this area. Oops, that's gone. Compute the area, demand that the area law be obeyed, that the entanglement be proportional to the perimeter of the entangling region. That's only true when theta is smaller than d minus 1. And you know, there are many examples of string theories of compressible phases that don't satisfy this. And my claim is that all not string theories. Gravity, phenomenological gravity theories. And my claim would be those theories probably don't have a consistent embedding in any kind of consistent quantum theory in the boundary. But those that have obeyed this will probably be OK. And then another feature you find, and this appears from the solution of these models explicitly or more generally, as argued by Ogawa and Takenagi Ogajin, is that you take, again, it just takes 3 lines. You take this metric. So if you know this metric, you know what the Einstein tensor is, g mu nu. Then you use Einstein's equation, g mu nu equals t mu nu. And then you impose a null energy condition. Well, so if you have the right computer program, it takes a few seconds and out pops. That's only true if this inequality is true. So z has to be greater than or equal to 1 plus theta over d. I would claim these are fairly rigorous inequalities, or any boundary theory, strongly coupled boundary theory, which is described approximately by a gravity theory. So Fermi liquid is not one which has a simple gravity theory with the scale invariant structure. But a non-Fermi liquid, a strongly coupled theory on the boundary, may have a simple gravitational description, and then it must satisfy these inequalities. Now, what gets me really excited is that now if you put theta equals d minus 1 and d equals 2, then you get z is greater than or equal to 3/2. This should be greater than or equal to. So this 3/2, amazingly, is exactly the lower bound is exactly the value found in the field theory. So this is really the first hint of a quantitative connection then between these two very different approaches, that maybe they're actually talking about the same thing. Maybe this is a complete accident. I don't know. We'd love to understand where this three, you know, what, how significant this is. But given the fact that so many other things work out, and this was really just this came out at the very end. It's pretty remarkable, I think. And I claim this is pretty strong evidence that these two pictures are closely related to each other. Okay, so that's the end of my talk. So let me, I forgot. So this is some pictures of this the same thing here. This is the non-Fermi liquid state. You have some charge Q on the boundary, and there's some electric field going out to infinity with this IR metric over there. Now, one of the things you can do, which I haven't described, which is further evidence for this picture, you can explicitly by hand add in fermions. So you add in fermions on the bulk. And what that means is those fermions now are gauge invariant fermions. So those you can see, no problem. They have a regular Fermi surface of gauge invariant fermions. And that's, you know, all this work of Hong Liu and John McGreevy and so many others computing fermion Green's functions, actually starting with Sung-Sik Lee. In holography is really the creative functions of those gauge invariant fermions. So they have visible Fermi surfaces in contrast to the hidden Fermi surfaces that I'm talking about. And if you put those in by hand, you find that, again, the only thing they do is just change the IR metric by subtracting away from the charge. And that's exactly, again, what you expect from Luttinger's theorem. So if you put in fermions, they actually eat away some of this hidden Fermi surface charge. So it's that's evidence that this hidden Fermi surface charge this hidden charge is actually associated with some kind of fermionic degrees of freedom. And if you put in enough, then you get a Fermi liquid where the thing terminates. Okay, so let me I've already said that. So let me conclude by just making a table of approach A and approach B. So in field theory, you know, we have the advantage that we can fix the gauge. And so we can see this Fermi surface of these gapless fermions. But in holography, it's completely hidden in a sense. But it's also hidden here in as if you were focusing on just gauge invariant observables. Then in this theory that I summarized, in fact, it's true that the entropy density is T to the 1 over Z. So I didn't mention this earlier. So this non-Fermi liquid state in field theory does look like, as far as the entropy is concerned, just like a 1D system. And so now, on the holography side, we impose this same condition. Entropy goes as T to the 1 over Z, and that fixes the exponent theta. Then for this kind of theory, there's evidence that there is log violation of entanglement entropy with various special restrictions in the prefactor. And for theta, again, the same value of theta, I find exactly the same features. So the three-loop analysis shows Z is 3/2. Here it shows Z is greater than 3/2 or equal to some limiting case. There's a Luttinger theorem here. And if I take the value of Kf from the entanglement entropy, there also seems to be a Luttinger theorem here. And finally, the very last part, if you add in gauge neutral fermions, they act on the system in exactly the way you would have expected, assuming they were hidden Fermi surfaces. Okay, so that's it. Thank you.
Are there any questions? So the only input from sort of confidence matter is that let's go with T2 1
and log violation of entanglement entropy. But I only need one of those. S equals T to 1 over Z. From holography, I would deduce that follows. So I go to holography, I just input T goes to 1 over Z, I get log violation of entanglement entropy, which is also what you find in kinetics. It's all consistent, yeah. All you need to input is a specific heat goes as T to the 1 over Z for any, and that's, I think, and that's, you know, essentially proven for the strongly coupled Fermi safe surface state in one dimension. In two dimensions. And once you know that, so once you know this and you fix theta, then you get this for free. And no, you don't just get log violation, you get the Q dependence right, you get the shape dependence right, you get the temperature dependence right, everything comes all right. As far as we can tell, everything we've tested looks okay. I think everything we can test. We'd love to know about more tests. No, there isn't. It seems looks okay. So, you know, there probably are supersymmetric gauge theories that violate the area law because they have huge degeneracies in the spectrum. So there's nothing inconsistent as such, but it's unnatural because at least in kinetic matter, we don't have such huge degeneracies in the spectrum. So it's like the Kagame lattice having a flat band. That will probably violate the, if you had an exactly flat band, it would probably violate the area law. So there are probably string theoretical models like that, and they can, but they're not generic. I would claim that they're not generic. Generically, you want theta to be smaller than d minus 1. Yeah, it may be. Yeah, so that would be nice to study. Yeah, of course. But so I don't think there's any contradiction with theta being d minus 1, but it's not natural. It's not generic. Yeah.
You mentioned there are
on the other hand, Z smaller than the other one may lead to contradiction because you violate the null energy condition. Sorry.
You mentioned there are some constraints on the couplings in this Lagrangian in order to get that is equal to d-1.
So to get that IR metric, you need, you know, Z of phi going as e to the gamma phi or something, and Z of phi going as e to the minus delta phi. So there are these two numbers here for large phi. And so their ratio has to be some specific value to get theta equals d minus 1. Again, it would be nice to go from a top down, to start from a string theory and derive that ratio. I mean, here we just, related to what Sung said, at the level of this theory, theta equals d minus 1 is not necessary. On the other hand, z is greater than theta over this, this you do get. Doesn't matter what you take any theory you want, and you solve it in a stable manner, this will be true. This you do get. But this you don't get, you have to fine-tune it. But I claim it really should be there, because that's the only way you get a sensible compressible phase.
In string theory, you have the models where these ratios differ.
From?
Models with different ratios.
I know.
Top-down approach.
Okay, well, is this a consistent decoupling and is it a stable phase? I mean, I would worry. I mean, I don't know which paper you're referring to. I'd love to find out more about this. But my conjecture would be anything except that would have theta equals d minus 1 and give you compressible phases are ultimately fine-tuned or unstable. Okay. I know. Okay. It's a strong claim. Many people are unhappy with it, but okay, there it is.
What was wrong with
violated? Maybe Rob or somebody should. Okay, I haven't found a solution where it's violated. So I think Rob or Ananda might. So the question is, what goes wrong if a non-energy condition is violated? You get naked singularities and instabilities and so on, right?
Typically, it's related to what you can relate it to instability.
I mean, I think this Hawking area theorem on the area law increase of the area of the horizon relies on non-energy conditions, right?
That's actually okay, but the problem is basically the vacuum becomes unstable because you have negative energy density regions.
I see. Okay.
You produce that plus photons or whatever from the vacuum, so the system goes away.
Okay. All right. Lots of bad things, I guess, is the summary. I don't have a good intuition. This is really the first time I'm hearing about this non-energy condition. We kind of stumbled on this. We were just looking at the most general solution, and we're finding this is always the case. And then, yeah. Yeah, it is William. Yeah.
This eta, did you guys find it?
Sorry,
this,
eta?
Yeah, the refactor.
Oh, so this, again, my mistake. This eta. No, there was another eta in the fermion-Green's function. Those are totally different things. This one, yeah, it's a number that, again, it will depend on gamma and delta and various things here. But it's independent of the UV conditions. Yeah, we found it. I mean, it depends on it's the analog of a universal characteristic of some theory. I mean, the coefficient eta is some known function for this model of gamma and delta. We can write it down. And z and theta, it just depends on that. But it doesn't depend on anything, any kind of UV boundary condition. It doesn't depend on what boundary conditions you put over here on your scalar field, whether you put Messinos here or not. All of these doesn't change the value of eta. You can put fermions, you can put all kinds of matter here, you change the boundary condition. It doesn't depend on any of that. That's what we showed.
But in terms of intuition, what this eta does,
I mean, eta is like it's like a critical exponent. It's a universal amplitude. It's the analog of the 1/12th that you got from the Fermi liquid. And I don't think we understand, and from the field theory side, what the value of eta is. I think it'd be nice to pin that down.
But is it like the analog of the central charge?
It is something like that. But I mean, that's the analogy to all of those things. But these are for Luttinger's theorem, not for. And Luttinger's theorem, as you can see, is intimately tied to conservation laws and Gauss's law and things like that. That's where it comes from, all of these results. So I think these things could probably be proved by people who know more gravity than I do. But so as our condensed matter intuition led us to make all these statements. I mean, for us, we would just have this huge, messy equation. Looking at them, I would have had no inkling that I should look for this feature, except for my condensed matter intuition. Then I look for it and found, yes, actually it does work.
More question?
On the holotropic side, when you calculate this entanglement entropy,
yeah.
there is a leading divergence still.
No, this is the leading term. There's no divergence because the divergence is on the subleading part that goes as the area. This is, goes as area log area. So as long as you know this constant, this is much larger than one, this is the leading term. All the thing that there's a thing that depends on the cutoff only goes as the area. So that's the subleading term.
But if the cutoff is UV cutoff, that is still dominating over the
No, it will not. I mean, as long as this is much greater than 1, which is simply the condition that KFL is much, much bigger than 1. So the size of the entanglement region has to be much, much bigger than 1 over KF. That's always the condition. In that condition, it doesn't depend on what the cutoff is. This is the leading term.
And the fact that you have this KFL log KFL, in two dimensions, you can't have anything more exotic in sitting in front of the log term.
More exotic meaning what?
KFL to some power.
No, you couldn't. We don't know of any examples. Okay, they could, you know, this is modulo the assumption that everything we have learned in condensed matter is all there is. There could be some really new interesting states. We'll see. Okay, but we don't know of any example. I mean, that would be a very strong violation of area law, you know, and I think it's hard to believe that such things happen, but okay.
More questions?
Okay. Thank you.